This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Inside Story on BFM 89.9.
Good evening. This is Inside Story with Lee Chui Lin and Shamila Ganesan. Tonight, an update on sexual harassment in schools and Ayn Husniza's case.
First, the teacher that Ayn referenced in her initial video has filed a defamation suit against her and her father. We discuss the ramifications of this. And then, Awam has just released a study looking into sexual harassment and period spot checks in schools. We're finding out more.
So we want to know, you know, these issues have been in the spotlight a lot this year. Has the government done enough to address it? You can call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Inside Story. It is 6:07, and today's show, I apologize in advance, is probably going to be a heavy one because in some ways it is a mixture of an update and summation, right, on some of the issues that we've been talking about in schools, particularly when it comes to situations of harassment, rape culture and the like. So to start off, there have been some updates in the case involving Ayn Husniza. You may remember that last April, she posted a TikTok video sharing that a male teacher in her school had made rape jokes during a physical and health education class. It's very important to note that she never named the teacher and she didn't name her school. This, however, did go viral, which has had a lot of subsequent headlines and discussions since. And Make School a Safer Place, the hashtag, actually also went viral on social media, sparking a nationwide conversation on rape culture in our community and in our school. Other girls and women also came forward to share similar experiences. And in May, it was reported that the teacher was transferred to the Selangor Education Department for a police investigation, and later on, no further action was taken. Subsequent to that, on August 4th, Ayn's family essentially received a letter of demand from the teacher for allegedly defaming him. He had five demands, including an apology and monetary compensation of 1 million ringgit. And now that brings us to where we are, because yesterday, Ayn's father, Saiful Nizam Abdul Wahab, basically stated on Facebook that the male teacher has now filed a suit against both himself and Ayn at the Shah Alam Sessions Court.
Yes, and this is the first time, actually, that the teacher is being named because of the suit, of course. So his name is Khairul Nizam Sanuddin. And among the types of damages that Khairul is claiming is for loss of reputation and credibility. And case management for the suit has been fixed for tomorrow. Now, needless to say, this has caught a lot of attention and a lot of criticism for the fact that, well, as we've outlined, no real action has been taken against the teacher. However, the fact that he is suing for damage to reputation and credibility really seems like it feels so misplaced almost for the average person to listen to the turn of events, and the fact that this is something that's that hasn't yet been addressed by people in authority. So lots to unpack there. And this is coming on the wake of a report that Awam has released. And we mentioned that earlier, right? A lot of this is happening as a result of Ayn, the highlighting of the kinds of abuse that takes place in school, the kind of lack of action, really, that happens after these cases are highlighted. So the All Women's Action Society released a report on 770 testimonies of abuse that fall under four major violation categories: period spot checks, sexual harassment, bullying, and other things, which include things like abuse of power, stalking, grooming, and so on. And these testimonies were compiled by Save the Schools MY, which is a platform that was created in April following Ayn's initial TikTok video. And these testimonies essentially identified, or rather became the way to identify 1,145 incidents of abuse, 1,495 violations, 24.4% of all survivors experienced multiple violations. And I think this is quite damning. Sexual harassment alone constitutes 75% of these violations.
Yeah. I think that it's important here to say that you should read the report if you can, because the report, I think, does a better job than we possibly could of laying out the scope of this issue. There are so many things, there are so many numbers, and that includes, for example, 24% more or less of the abuse incidents led to consequences that affected survivors' mental health, their school life, their relationships, their livelihoods. We had people skipping or no longer attending school events. And we also had the fact that 89% of the violations occurred in primary and secondary institutions of learning. We're talking about people at very young ages. I don't know. There's so much to talk about because it includes the fact of who is doing the violating, whether it's teachers, fellow students, and the ramifications of it really go on and on. So essentially, today we want to look at the fact that, yeah, period spot checks, rape jokes, sexual harassment in schools, all of this has been a conversation pretty much all this year. And if anything, it looks as if, A, the repercussions of coming forward might not be what we expected or wanted, as we're going to address in the update to Ian's situation. But the other thing is also that the scope of the issue may be larger than we ever wanted it to be, as we're going to highlight in the report from AWAM. So that's our show today. We'll be starting off after this by hearing from family lawyer Hani Tan about the legal situation involving Ayn Husniza, but we'd like to hear from you. Considering all these issues having been in the headlines, has the government done enough to address issues of sexual harassment in schools, for instance? Call 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
It is 6:15 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. And today we are talking about some updates, basically, on sexual harassment in schools and Ayn Husniza's case. That's actually the one that we're starting with. But we'd like to know, considering that rape jokes in schools, period spot checks in schools, these are some of the issues that have been in the headlines this year. Considering all that, has the government done enough to address the situation? Call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. And now joining us on the line is family lawyer Hani Tan. Hani, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Hi everyone. Good evening. What a way to end the year.
I know, not necessarily what we wanted, I think. Let's start with the latest news that both Ayn and her father have been sued for alleged defamation. Did this course of action come as a surprise to you?
No, not at all, because I think the teacher has already indicated, I think quite some time ago, that he would be suing. I think now because he has filed the suit, so he has, in that sense, outed himself by naming himself in the suit, which he has to. And it's also quite interesting that he's filed it in the Sessions Court. So it's clear that he doesn't believe he can get more than $1 million in damages.
And what constitutes defamation, and what are the grounds for this case, given that Ayn never actually revealed the name of the teacher that she spoke about in her video?
Okay, so I just want to be clear that this interview, I won't be commenting on that case specifically. So my comments are made generally. The first thing about identification, just because somebody is not named doesn't mean that he cannot be identified. So if that person is identifiable, then there are other things that swing into play and you may be held liable. So you defame someone when you say something that is untrue about that person and it harms his reputation. I mean, that's like in a nutshell.
And Ayn has countersued for emotional distress, and understandably, I mean, if we don't talk about the case itself and how the back and forth there, generally speaking, can you tell us about the level of stress and trauma that events like this can cause?
Okay, so maybe I'll talk a little bit about what is the tort of emotional distress. Tort is a civil wrong, and the usual remedy for civil wrongs are damages, which is basically monetary compensation, and injunctions, which are usually orders from courts to order somebody to do something or to refrain from doing something. So if you want to succeed in the tort of emotional distress, the claimant will have to prove some kind of emotional disturbance, you know, usually it's like fear of being harmed, and then it will manifest itself in things like insomnia, you know, fluctuations in weight, inability to concentrate. I mean, the list is actually quite endless. And in order to strengthen the claim, even though it's not compulsory, usually an expert will be called, a psychologist or a psychiatrist, that can give evidence as to some kind of, you know, the level of distress that the person is feeling. And when it comes to damages and all that, you also need to see if there is any long-term care involved, you know, because it's not so easy, like, you know, something happened to you and then after 2 months, everything is over. So usually there's a lot of long-term repercussions and you need therapy, counseling, and actually in more challenging cases, you might also need medication. So all of this will have an impact, you know, in terms of the amount of damages, the compensation that the claimant will receive.
Honey, I just wanted to know, though, I mean, does that disadvantage people who don't have access to specialists or to people who would be able to verify and provide all these additional information, I suppose?
It depends. It depends on who you're calling. So if you're going to subpoena somebody from the public health sector or the public universities, then you don't really have to pay them, you know, in the sense for their expertise, like you don't have to pay them like 10,000 ringgit for a report. You may ask them, usually what we will do is we will talk to them and say, are you able to do this? Can you give us a report? You know, and usually they're quite obliging. We usually have to subpoena them. So it's not so much like, you know, you can just ask them to come and they will come, you know. So in terms of costs, actually, it's not so much. The cost, I'm afraid, is going to be more for the lawyers. Truly speaking.
So looking beyond the legal outcomes of this for the people involved, what are some of the potential ramifications of bringing a lawsuit like this?
Well, I'm hopeful that by now, even without the lawsuit, the education ministry will have a policy on what is acceptable behavior in a school setting, you know. They ought to know by now that not all these jokes, not just about rape, you know, about how you look and, you know, how you sit and, you know, how you're dressed, your tudung is slipping, you know, I can see this, it's turning people on. I mean, all these can actually be sexually harassing. And that could actually, you know, end up with more suits against the education ministry.
We have a WhatsApp here from Anwar who says, it's understandable that many sexual harassment allegations have surfaced after this case and the Me Too movement. Without denying that these things happen, what about the truth behind these allegations? Everyone is innocent until proven guilty. So in this case, the teacher is just trying to clear his name because the case already tarnished it. How would you respond?
Innocent until proven guilty is a criminal law concept. So right now we're talking about a tort, a civil wrong. And I always want to emphasize that just because you cannot prove something, so in a criminal matter, you have to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's a really, really hard and high level of proof. But in a civil setting, the standard of proof is on the balance of probabilities, you know. So it doesn't mean that you have to prove it to such a high standard. You have to persuade the judge to just believe you over believing the other side. Then you would admit your proof. And, you know, innocent until proven guilty, just because even if, okay, say for example, even in this civil case, and you can't make that standard of balance of probabilities, just because you can't prove it doesn't mean it didn't happen, you know. If you actually sit in on any criminal matters, when the judge is giving his judgment, he doesn't say, I proclaim you, you know, Mr. X, as innocent. No, what he says is, the prosecution has failed to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. So that's all. He's not even saying that it didn't happen. All he's saying is that you cannot prove it up to this standard. So it's very important for us to make this distinction because, you know, for survivors, it's really already very disheartening, you know. So when people say, oh, you know, he was innocent, I would say, no, he just wasn't found guilty.
Honey, I wanted to pick up on this idea of someone suing a claimant of sexual harassment, for instance, right? When people talk about suing them for defamation and so on, might it pave the way for more women to face repercussions for speaking up against harassment?
Well, making official claims and filing suits are always challenging, especially for women and girls, you know. So, yes, you are opening up yourself to, you know, like when Ayn spoke up, now she's subject to a suit. And then, you know, all the online harassment that went on for her, I mean, that was also quite horrible. So, I mean, the problem is it's about our law, you know. So our law is not objective, it's not unbiased, and it's not neutral. And so it doesn't reflect a woman's experience of the law. And that is why whenever women and girls speak out, especially about some kind of sexual assault, it's really very tough.
And what does this tell us about a potential gap in the legal system, especially when it comes to someone's right and ability to speak out against harassment and violence, especially violence against women, since this really began with a rape joke?
Right. So it actually, you have to then move backwards a bit and look at the lawmaking process, you know. That's why we keep saying you must have a minimum of 30% of women in parliament, or, you know, the state legislature or, you know, whichever lawmaking body. Because then when you have more diverse people, a better view can be put forward. And definitely before you pass any laws, especially on women's rights, you have to consult with the stakeholders, you know. Especially, like, say, for example, in this case, it's about students. You have to consult the students. And I can almost guarantee you that any policy which is, you know, made by the education ministry, I don't think they've even consulted like 1,000 students, you know. So if you're going to make something that affects someone, you have to consult the right people. And the right people doesn't mean you need a PhD or something like that. You need to be, I mean, like a student if it affects you. That's why when we say, when you make laws about women, talk to women.
So how would the existence of a Sexual Harassment Act then help in empowering survivors, especially when it comes to speaking up?
I think many people believe that it will make it easier, the procedure, you know. So complainants think that it will be easier and speedier, especially, so if we're talking about sexual harassment in the workplace, then they're thinking a mechanism, you know, in a workplace scenario may be faster. But I think, I suppose if you're a lawyer, you'll know that that's never the end of the road. Loser can always appeal, review, you know, and if you end up in court, if you end up at certain levels of court, there will always be appellate court. So you might have a minimum of two more levels of appeal. So when people think it's a short and faster route, it's not always so, you know.
So are there legal safeguards that one should consider when speaking out against harassment, I guess particularly in a public space or an online space?
I would say whenever you want to make an allegation, it is always very important for you to think about, do you have the evidence to back you up? But I want to be clear, I am not saying that just because there is no so-called evidence that you don't speak up, right? Because I think people always think of evidence as like a piece of paper or a recording, you know, or something like that, a photograph. But when something happens to you and you don't have any of that, see, I mean, and most usually, you know, rapes and any kind of sexual assault against women, usually it will be when no one else is there. I mean, who's going to, I mean, of course, there's gang rape and, you know, where people are also watching you being raped. But the most common type is when there's just the two of you, you know. But there are other types of circumstantial evidence that the court will take into account. So the court will look at the totality of evidence. So, for example, if you've been sexually harassed and then there's no so-called evidence. So what did you do? You either told your best friend or co-worker, and if it's so bad, you may have lost, you know, you just quit your job, right? And other things will also be happening to you. Like I was saying just now, you know, you can't sleep, you can't concentrate, you know. You may be going to see a doctor and saying, you know, I have all these symptoms. So you are going to see the doctor and you're saying, I have these symptoms. But you are not going to tell the doctor, my boss actually harassed me for over, you know, 4 months and now I'm having these symptoms. So the doctor will just treat your symptoms, you know, unless you tell the doctor, in which case the doctor might recommend a psychologist. But if you were to file a complaint or you know, file a case in court, all these sorts of evidence will be taken into account by the court. So I would say first thing is go and talk to a lawyer so that the lawyer can help you assess whether your evidence is good or not.
We just have about 30 seconds left. So MPs are calling for the Education Ministry to take a stand. What can they do? What could they have done to prevent this from escalating?
I think they have to make a stand. When something is wrong, take firm action. I mean, transferring somebody to another place and all that, you know, that's not going to solve the issue. So I think talk about it. Have an open forum, you know, and talk about it in that school itself. See whether it might not only be that teacher, it could be more.
Honey, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, you're so welcome. Have a good day.
You too. That was family lawyer Honey Tan weighing in on the updates in the case involving Ain Husniza, in which the previously unnamed teacher, Khairul Nizam Sanuddin, is now alleging defamation, suing for that, basically. And after this, we're going to be talking about a report from AWAM about instances of abuse in our schools. We'd like to hear from you. Has the government done enough to address this issue? Call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
It is just about 6:38 and you are listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. And today, it's a rather heavy one, I have to say. We're talking about sexual harassment and other such incidents in schools. We are just about to look at a new report that actually dives into that in more detail. But we started off earlier by looking at some updates involving the case of Ain Husniza. So we've been asking you for your thoughts and whether the government has done enough to address it. You can call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. And before we get to our next segment, here are some messages.
So Farouk says, I agree there should be a survey with stakeholders. And I wanted to pick up on that, one, because we are shortly going to be talking to AWAM and, you know, they did do a survey with, well, students particularly. But it always strikes me how things like this happen and NGOs and other civil organizations jump in to try and find out what to do, what needs to be done and to get more information. What is the ministry doing? And that's why this always deeply disappoints me, because that survey, that action should come from the government. We also have a message from Natasha who says, since Ain went public, I never once cared to know who the teacher is because it's not about him. The victim is Ain, and there have been many Ains over the years. The highlight is the issue of rape jokes and harassment. Ain has done so much to bring this matter to light, and people are now talking and debating about these important issues. And no, the government has done very little. A simple transfer to a different school as punishment, what good does that do, especially to the students in that school? I coach my female students to respect themselves and to know their rights, but I stress to my male students on respecting their female classmates and the importance of calling out their bros when they're doing something wrong towards the girls. The amount of male students who have displayed their hatred and name-calling towards Ain is so disturbing.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I also think that this comes down to exactly it, right? Who is supposed to be doing the thing, right? When it comes to the schools, surely this is something that the Education Ministry needs to be taking seriously. I did want to, since Natasha brought up male students, female students, I thought we could close off for now at least with this from Russell, who called earlier saying, every parent who has a daughter in school must co-sign a petition against the teacher and or ministry officials for not taking the steps to resolve this issue as a deterrent. I would say you don't have to have a daughter in school. So while I think that that's a great start, this is not an issue that only involves women. Sexual harassment is an issue that involves everybody.
I completely agree. I think every parent and even people who are not parents but actually care about the values that we hold as a society should take an interest in issues like this.
So keep those thoughts coming. We are talking today about incidents of sexual harassment and period spot checks, for example, occurring in schools. We'd like to hear from you. Has the government done enough to address this? You can call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. So while earlier we spoke about Ain Husniza and the fact that the teacher who was, shall we say, featured in the video has now filed a defamation suit against her, we now want to look at the larger setting that allows all this to happen. What's happening in schools? schools. And to understand that, there is a new report that is out from AWAM, the All Women's Action Society. So to find out more, we're crossing over to Janelle Tan, Information and Communications Officer at AWAM. Janelle, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you very much again for having me. It's great to be back.
Could you start by telling us why AWAM first set out to collect these testimonies?
So just to give everyone a bit of context, like back in April this year, we did conduct an analysis of 275 testimonies, and that was with the help of testimonies compiled online by Nalisa Alia Amin and also Terry Dai Hyden. And while the reason that we wanted to do a second batch is just very simple, which is that more data is power. So when you actually represent more voices of survivors and their experiences, it's essentially to give everyone a big picture of just how widespread this issue of abuse and violence in schools is in our education system. And we hope that through by portraying these experiences, it will propel all key stakeholders, including the government and also schools, to take concrete action to address this issue.
What was the process of collecting the testimonies? What was the methodology that you used?
So basically, the testimonies were compiled by Save the Schools Mai through a Google form, and we collaborated with the founder of STS Mai, Hubi Putri, to provide us access to these testimonies. As for the methodology concerned, we actually sort of we look back at the analysis that we did, and from there we sort of like looked at what are the existing variables that we can improve on, and also what are the new ones that we can add. So of course we looked at existing variables like survivor gender and age, type of education institution, which state the education institution is located, perpetrator's relationship to the survivor, and also the category of the violation. New variables that we've added would basically be, so previously in the April testimonial analysis, we just looked generally at sexual harassment, period spot checks, and bullying. But in this particular analysis, we actually broke down further. So for example, for sexual harassment, we would classify further by physical, psychological, verbal, gestural, online, visual. Period spot checks would be classified further as groping, strip slash show pad, using tissues or using cotton buds. Bullying would be physical, verbal, social, and cyber. We also took into account other violations such as child grooming and stalking. So that's just one huge improvement that we've made to the analysis. Two other significant variables that I would definitely like to highlight that we have added in would be what happens to the survivor as a result of reporting or not reporting the violations, as well as specific mental health outcomes that survivors experience as a result of the violations. So it was a very iterative process whereby like we read the testimonies, and then in the process, we improved our variables and our collection process as we go by. Yeah.
So we are speaking today with Janelle Tan, Information and Communications Officer at AWAM, about the report that they just released looking into abuses of these sorts in our schools. After this, we're going to take a closer look at the content of the report, from survivors to essentially how this could be used. If you have thoughts, send them our way. That number to call, 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
It's 6:47 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. We've been taking a look today at the situation around sexual harassment in our schools, other such incidents. And now we're looking at a new report that sets out to detail some of these incidents. We've been asking you, though, for your thoughts. Has the government done enough to address this? Simple enough question. Call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. So we've been speaking with Janelle Tan, Information and Communications Officer at AWAM, on the report. Janelle, talk to us about the profile of survivors. I mean, at what age did they experience these incidents of abuse?
So I'll just provide a general snapshot of what we generally see across the testimonies here. So predominantly, we're seeing female secondary school students. The majority of our testimonies have been obtained from the peninsula in Malaysia, so not as many come from the east of Malaysia. predominantly former child survivors, because as per our findings, almost 20% of survivors in our testimonies are still children in schools right now. Primarily, these incidents primarily happen in primary and secondary educational institutions, primarily in government primary and secondary schools, but we also find them in Sekolah Agama, Sekolah Berasrama Penuh, or hostel schools under the MOE's jurisdiction, MARA colleges, even young women as well, universities and colleges. Other places that happen would include even in homes, be it survivors or the perpetrators, even in tuition centers, Sunday schools, school camps, LRT or train stations, even on public or school transport, be it by drivers, by peers, and etc. So it happens all across the board. As for the youngest age that we've seen, for sexual harassment and bullying, right, from the youngest is actually 5 years old, disclosed age, yeah. And this survivor, the 5-year-old survivor, was actually molested by a male peer when she was taking a nap. For bullying, it was actually a male survivor and he was 5 years old and it was actually, I think as part of punishment, he was forced by the teacher to stand in front of the rest of the class shirtless. So that was just sexual harassment and bullying. For period spot checks and other violations, thus far it's in primary school. The youngest survivor documented was 7 years old.
Who were the perpetrators?
The largest group is actually peers, but peers as the largest group is only in sexual harassment. Across other violation categories, peers have thus far been the second largest group. School figures of authority is the largest group of perpetrators in period spot checks, bullying, and other violation types. In sexual harassment, they are the second largest group, so it's either one or the other. The whole range of school figures of authority that we have seen as perpetrators include teachers, religious teachers, be it ustas or ustazas, coaches, principals, wardens, counselors, facilitators, you know, like external facilitators who are brought in to facilitate camps and etc., speakers in certain external school events or lectures, school or university staff, even scoutmasters. Except for period spot checks where ustazas are the most prevalent perpetrators within this whole big group of school figures of authority, right? In the case of sexual harassment, bullying, and other violation types, teacher actually constituted the largest perpetrator subgroup. Other perpetrators, of course, include family members, prefects, seniors, intimate partners, strangers, and etc., but those are the minority.
Did most survivors report these cases?
No, unfortunately. The prevalences are really, really high. So just to give, just provide everyone with figures. So for example, in sexual harassment violations alone, right? In 1,046 of them, 81.4% of sexual harassment violations were unreported. 93.2% of period spot check violations were unreported. Everything is pretty much in the 80s or 90s, except for other violation types, whereby in this particular category, it's 67.1%. But yeah, so the numbers are very, very, very much high.
So for those who did report, was action taken or did they face reprisals for reporting?
Again, very unfortunately, across violations that have been reported, right, no action taken has been the top most common consequence experienced by survivors as a result of reporting. But aside from that, there were also other negative consequences. So for example, not being taken seriously is also another very common, it's among the top three actually, consequences that were seen as a consequence of not reporting violations of sexual harassment, period spot checks. Actually, it's all across all four categories. Yep. For period spot checks and bullying, for example, among the top 4 to 5 consequences that we saw were actually, for example, being asked to keep quiet by authorities about the whole incident, or being further harassed by the perpetrator or other third parties. So let me give you an example. In period spot checks, there was one account that was actually being filed by a third party. So this third party bystander actually witnessed that. So survivors who were groped by the teachers during the violations, their parents knew about the whole incident and the parents voiced out to the whole school. But the consequence at the end was that these survivors were warned by the figures of authority in school to not make a big deal about the incident. So that's an example of, in a way, harassment by other third parties in the school that were not perpetrators. But yeah, so other consequences, for example, that were seen as well included survivor being punished after reporting in certain cases by teachers or survivors transferring out of the educational institution because nothing was done or because they were harassed by the teachers and or students in combination so badly that they just had to leave.
Overall, could you give us some examples of how these incidents have affected survivors in the long term?
In the long term?
Well, short and long term, just impact overall.
Sure. So we had to classify, because of the variety of consequences that we've seen, we had to classify, also putting aside, just to clarify, these psychosocial consequences did not include the consequences that I've mentioned earlier. That happened as a result of reporting. It just, we only, for psychosocial consequences, we only looked at mental health, school, lifestyle, and relationship outcomes that happened to survivors as a result of the violation. So for mental health, right, the most common ones that we've seen were actually being traumatized, self-blame, and not feeling safe. But we have also seen consequences such as suicidal ideation, attempted suicides and self-harm, so the more extreme end of the mental health spectrum. It's also important to note that we've seen 17 formal mental health diagnosis, of which anxiety and depression consisted 75% of them. We've also, other mental health conditions that we've seen included post-traumatic stress disorder and even dissociative identity disorder. For school, sorry, just to touch on that, because that's really important as well, especially for the Ministry of Education. So survivors actually skipped, no longer attend school events, or they stopped going to school entirely, or academic performance experiencing decline.
So taking all of this into account, what do you think is actually missing in our schools that allows these sorts of abuses to happen to so many people?
I would say three huge gaps, actually. The first one is a severe lack of awareness of gender, basically gender awareness, and very important concepts such as consent and physical boundaries. And this is not just seen among figures of authority, it's also seen among students. So that's why peer perpetration rates are so high. Another huge gap that needs to be addressed is actually the school culture. A school culture that contains these characteristics. One, victim blames survivor for provoking the perpetrator to commit those violations. The other aspect to that culture is the problematic values of not questioning figures of authority, especially when they've done something wrong, and also maintaining the school's reputation, priorities on maintaining the school's reputation, especially when violations like these happen. So this school culture overall actually silences survivors and prevents them from coming forward. The third gap is actually inadequate redress mechanisms that are in place for survivors. So survivors, they do not know who to go to and where they can seek help from, because such mechanisms are inadequate or they do not exist at all. So these gaps are these gaps were highlighted as we looked at the testimonies.
And how does AWAN plan to use these testimonies?
In three ways, basically. One is to use, so as you guys will be aware, we have already made our report public. So that was meant for the public's consumption. The reason for doing so is just to spread greater public awareness of this whole issue of abuse and violence in schools, and also to allow the public to hold the government accountable as well in prioritizing the safety and well-being of students in schools, because NGOs alone to push this issue forward will not be enough. We will need the public as well. The second important thing is to engage, to use this report to engage the ministry to provide long-term gender sensitivity training among school figures of authority. Why? Because school figures of authority, they are important role models when it comes to values and behaviors that students can emulate from. So by training these teachers and all other school figures of authority, we would be better off in terms of creating a ripple effect in creating a school culture that is zero tolerant against sexual harassment. The last very equally important part is that this report will also be used as part of our advocacy work to table and advocate for a survivor-centric sexual anti-sexual harassment bill. And one of the provisions that we have been extensively demanding is organizational commitment. And this organizational commitment includes educational institutions. So having anti-sexual harassment policies alongside the aforementioned regular awareness raising activities would, again, also create as many sexual harassment free spaces as possible. And that's what we want in Malaysia.
Janelle, thank you so much for speaking with us today. That was Janelle Dunn, Information and Communications Officer at the All Women's Action Society, or AWAM, talking about their latest report, which basically covers what we've been talking about, sexual harassment, incidents of bullying and the like in schools. Keep those thoughts coming. This has been Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.